Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
From Los Angeles, I'm Justin Zvakas.
And I'm Zach Bertie. Welcome to AnCast, doing a call-out show this week. We originally had someone else scheduled, but we had to move them around, so they'll be here. It's a really cool guest. They'll be here in the beginning of June that I'm sure you guys will kind of lose your shit over. But how's it going, Justin? How's it been?
My apartment is a mess because, actually, for reasons I'll get to later, I have most of my DVD collection on the floor.
Oh, my God.
I have over 1,000 discs, just the ones I bought, let alone my burns.
Yeah, I know. I've seen the ridiculous binders. But we'll talk about that in a bit. Have you been watching anything?
Well, I was traveling most of this week. I was just got back from Detroit to see the family, which was always good. Mm-hmm. I was sustained on the plane trip back by Crusher Joe, the OVAs.
Now, I've never seen that. I've always been a little intrigued by it. It's like a space thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's by the creator. It's actually the genesis of Dirty Pair.
Right.
And the setup is kind of similar, you know, gang of misfits goes on mysterious space missions and is usually dicked around by the powers that be. Mm-hmm. And the movie I had seen years and years ago, and I really enjoyed it. Animego released this two-disc DVD box set years ago. I think it's out of print now.
Of course.
That had the movie and both OVAs. The movie is kind of awesome, and it was unique back then because Crusher Joe and his team were really the first kind of anime space heroes that were just complete misanthropes.
Okay.
they're not jerks, but they don't want to be doing this, and they're expecting to be dicked around, and they're just not happy people. The OVAs dumbed that down quite a bit. They came a few years later, and they're kind of boring.
Yeah.
They're not as good. I was disappointed.
Was it just from a storytelling standpoint or an animation standpoint? Like, it just didn't have the budget, or what do you think?
No, animation-wise, they're pretty good. Video quality on one of the OVAs is atrocious, though. I think just, you know, the production values at the time.
Yeah.
But, okay, this is something that bugs me about a ton of 80s OVAs. Somehow, somebody thought it was cool to do the sort of, you know, Transformers style breakpoint where it's like, da 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 da.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It does that like every 5 seconds.
Really?
Yeah.
That's annoying.
And I'm like, that is not good storytelling. That just is this big speed bump right in the middle of the action.
Yeah. Wow. I'm just picturing like a, you know, an old Batman episode where he's like, Robin, to the Batcave. Like, now we have to get in the car.
Exactly. It's what that is. It's the pinnacle of lazy editing. And it was done in, you know, the crappy American television because it made it faster to edit. You didn't really have to worry so much about the flow of momentum.
Yeah.
Because if it wasn't working, you just throw that in. Suddenly everyone's awake.
Yeah. Suddenly, you know, you get the scene transition and the whole world's on fire or whatever.
Yeah.
You don't have to explain anything.
Exactly. And it's a cover for sloppiness, and that's exactly what it was here, and it didn't work as well because the story was too slow anyway. It's just kind of a missed opportunity. I was pissed off.
So,
but I guess there's a reason it sat on my shelf for years.
So it sounds like the movie's worth tracking down, but not the OVAs.
Movie is absolutely worth seeing, and all of them have a really spectacular dub by Coastal Recording, who is a dub studio that doesn't get employed at all anymore.
Yeah. They don't exist anymore, do they?
I think they exist in some capacity. The problem is anime always gets done, or at least got done by the people that hired them, is a really kind of slapdash last minute thing. You know, everything was always running late.
Yeah.
And the director, Scott Houle, was kind of famous for loving to take his time to get it right.
Mm-hmm. Rare.
And that didn't play so well.
Yeah. Huh. Well, that's very interesting. I think I'll borrow that from you at some point. Sounds pretty good.
That's good stuff.
I watched something decidedly more recent. I got the check discs in from NIS America for Toradora. which I've been looking forward to seeing for a while, like, because everyone, you know, it gets talked about like it's a masterpiece pretty often. You know, a lot of fans seem to point to this as like their most favorite recent show. And so I finally got to it, and it's, you know, kind of candy colored high school romantic comedy. It's about this guy who kind of looks, I guess he has a scary look to him. Like everyone thinks he's kind of a thug or a dangerous guy, but he's in reality, he's a nice guy. And this girl, this petite girl who looks innocent, but is a complete violent bitch. and so these two fall in love, I guess. And I'm about six episodes into it now, and I'm enjoying it. It's well written, and I think what works about it is, I think in the hands of a less talented writer, this would be, you know, this would be very throwaway, and it would probably rely way too much on easy personality tropes that get tossed into everything now.
I was going to say, it sounds an awful lot like Love, Hina.
It's not. Actually, it's pretty much nothing like Love, Hina.
Well, that's a plus.
Yeah, there's some, you know, violent humor, like he gets punched a lot and stuff like that, but it doesn't feel quite as lazy. Like, the characters are written very well, and I really like the lead male. He's a good character. I can sympathize with him. It's just interesting. It's fun. It's light and fluffy. I would not call it a masterpiece. I don't really see why people are losing their shit over it. It's just a pretty well-written romantic comedy, which I guess is fairly rare in that genre. Like American romantic comedies, it's rare to find a good one.
Right.
And so this is a good one. And I will be watching the rest of it, I think, unless it completely, you know, runs out of steam. But so far, so good. I'll toss it your way when I'm done with it.
Please do. I haven't heard anyone complain that it shits itself at the halfway point. So
I've heard that it shits itself at the end. The end is some kind of a cop out or some, but I don't know what the issue is. So there's that. But one thing I will say is that I guess the lead female character consistently wins the moe tournaments in Japan and Korea. And watching it, I didn't immediately ascribe her to some stereotype personality out of a can. That's a sign that it's pretty well written for what it is.
I was going to say, from what little I know about her and what you said, she's a complete bitch. It sounds like she barely fits the moe stereotype, or does so in you know, appearance only.
Yeah, so far.
I guess it goes to show that everyone's definition of moe is completely different.
Well, here's the thing, though. This is a totally enjoyable show if you know absolutely nothing about any of those tropes, you're not a fan of that genre. It's just well written. And that, guess, you know, it always comes back to that. It's just well written. It doesn't, all the other fandom stuff, none of that matters. It's just a decently written show. And that's, I mean, it's kind of a revelation, I guess, in this day and age.
But sadly.
So you mentioned, before we get to that, I wanted to clarify, or, you know, you're the expert on this. Okay, so Dentsu. What's going on with Dentsu?
Dentsu, this kind of made news about a month ago. What we posted and the news article that went up was more or less that Dentsu Japan is opening up another LA office. They have lots of American offices, but they're opening up an LA office specifically to deal with intellectual property rights. Perhaps related to anime. Some are, some aren't. Immediately, the forums, both ours and elsewhere, went to hell with people going, "Whoa, it's the return of Genion!" And then going off on these ridiculous tangents about what Genion did right, what they hope from DVDs in the future. And I just kind of looked at all these and just went, no.
Heavy
That's
sigh.
Not what it says.
Yeah, Genion's not coming back.
Genion is not coming back. What this is it is a licensing and sales office for Dentsu to try to sell things like Mame Shiba, you know, the little edamame dog thing.
Yeah, it's cute.
and other intellectual property things like that they have a hand in that they're trying to push to product manufacturers and licensing, basically hoping it'll be what Domo-kun has become here.
Oh, okay. So, like, they want to get into 7-Eleven.
7-Eleven or Target or, yeah, you know, any sort of company that would be able to take that and do something with the brand.
Yeah.
There is absolutely nothing to indicate at this point that this company is interested in the DVD market. And frankly, after getting burned so badly in the physical media market, I would be shocked and frankly appalled if Dentsu wanted to take another swing at it, especially with the condition the market's in.
Yeah, that would just be stupid. Okay, well, so that's, I'm glad that we, you know, we can clear that up because, the speculation. Oh, God.
Basically, I think everyone that remembers Jenny on fondly, and most of us do,
yeah,
they're just kind of, you know, hoping upon hope that, you know, they haven't heard the last of them. I'm sorry, you have heard the last of them.
Yeah,
it's over.
Yeah.
Sorry, move on.
That's it. Gotta move on.
Dead, so, buried, corpses rotting.
Yes, Heat Guy J is 6 feet under.
Ding.
So you mentioned that you're now, I find this hard to imagine because neither of us live in particularly vast places. And
we work in anime.
Yeah, exactly. And your media collection is huge. So it's all over the floor.
Okay, here's what happened. As with everyone, I've been collecting anime since the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. I started buying a shit ton of everything when DVDs started being the big shit. And you know, over the years I've tried paring down to just the basics, and then companies started going under, and I'm like, oh crap, if I don't get this stuff I might someday want to see again, if only just for reference, if I don't get it now, I may never have a chance. Mm-hmm. So I started rebuying stuff, and if I couldn't buy it, I downloaded it. And so I just, and you know, then I had my stupid little reauthoring projects. Over the years, I have amassed what I'm currently estimating to be around 1,000 DVDs.
Right.
I may be a little low in that because that's not counting all of the burns of obscure fan subs.
Which is a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So basically, I had completely given up at this point. Okay, first I went from the regular cases to, okay, I know, I'm going to thin pack everything. Mm-hmm. So I spent a couple $100 on thin packs for everything. And then double thin packs for everything.
Right.
Just to try to cram it on my little tiny shelf in my little tiny New York apartment.
Yeah.
Eventually, that just ended up being a non-starter. And as I was thinking about moving to LA, I'm just like, no, I'm not schlepping 20 boxes of DVDs again. I'm just not doing that. Mm-hmm. So I converted everything to sleeves and binders, and almost everything fit into these six huge binders that I schlepped from, you know, New York to LA.
Yeah.
Finally, I got to the point this week where I can't find anything anymore.
Oh, okay.
Nothing is in alphabetical order anymore, and you have to, if you have that many discs, you have to keep it in order.
Yeah, I was about to say, so you didn't index it or anything?
Well, I tried, but, you know, then I would get, like, I just bought Big Windup. Well, that goes in here, and I don't have the right number of sleeves. I guess I'm going to have to sandwich it over here.
Yeah.
that, and then, you know, reauthoring discs with, you know, better video and things like that. I'm just like, I'm finally to the point where just I have compartmentalized into so many stupid little pieces of my collection that I'm just like, this is a mess. I can't deal with this anymore. And the binders are getting too big and I don't have space for more. So I just finally broke down. I spent $100 this week and I got these two giant 600 disc DJ Flight cases.
Right.
Like, if you've ever been to a concert and you see them loading in the huge tubs of equipment,
yeah.
It's basically that for DVDs.
Right. Oh, my God.
So that arrives tomorrow, and I'm just kind of trying to prepare for their arrival, and I'm halfway between elation and, like, breaking down with a feeling of being completely overwhelmed at what the fuck I'm going to do with all this stuff.
Well, hey, we'll look at it this way. You put them next to each other, and they function as a coffee table. So there you go.
My name is Justin Savakis, and I have a problem.
Yeah. I mean, you've flirted with the notion of going all digital, right?
I have. Well, you mean like throwing it all on a
yeah,
server?
Yeah, and just getting rid of the physical media.
I can't afford a server that big.
Yeah, that's...
I don't think any of us could. I don't think ANN could afford a server that big.
You'd have to break into Pixar.
Seriously, we're talking about terabytes here.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Holy shit. Yeah. No. I mean, I go through phases up and down of collecting, and I'm on an up phase right now. And now I'm out of shelf space again, so I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. Moving to a bigger place, I guess.
My particular sickness right now comes from the fact that I just can't bear to throw away anything, and selling this stuff is literally not worth the postage.
Yeah, yeah, because a used DVD is worth negative 10 cents.
Yeah, I mean, I bought at a secondhand shop when I was trading in some discs, I bought the first 5 discs of Zipang.
Okay.
I don't really like this show. But,
I don't know why'd you buy it.
Well, I didn't. I wanted it just to see it.
Right.
Because I hadn't seen it, and this show is so unpopular, no one trades it online. Mm-hmm. And it's out of print because it's Jenny on. Yeah. I bought this, and I'm just like, I don't really want this. I don't really want to throw it away. It'll just end up in a landfill. I guess it'll come in handy someday. I'll put it here.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say you're a media hoarder.
This is out of control. I don't know what to do. This is my life.
Just wait till the camera crew shows up. Then you know you really have a problem.
Well, if they're going through these big tubs, you know, 2 years hence, and they find like a dead cat in one, we'll know what happened.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, before we get to get to our first caller, I just want to point out I was at FYE today, and I saw someone paying full price, $29.99. for the first single of Queen's Blade. So, way to go, Media Blasters.
You win, Media Blasters.
That's actually the first time I've seen someone purchasing anime in a store in a long time.
A full retail price single volume, $29.99.
For Queen's Blade, yeah, which only has 4 episodes on it.
Artis was right. Boobs and ninjas.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's go ahead and get to our first call.
Well, now who do we have here?
All right, before we get to the formal call-out show, we wanted to have our good buddy and a longtime friend of the show, Mike Tool, on. Bienvenidos, Señor Tool. Thanks for coming on.
Bienvenidos. Oh, wait a minute. I was supposed to say something else in Spanish, aren't I?
¿Cómo estás?
Muy bien, gracias. ¿Y tú?
Así, así.
I grew up in Detroit. The only second language I know is hate.
Yes. How's it going, Mike?
It's going pretty all right. I'm gearing up to go to the World Cup. I'm excited. I'm exhilarated and terrified. I just finished watching Aura Battler Dunbine, which is a pretty interesting example of early 80s mecha anime.
Yeah, I've always been curious about that show. I've only seen little bits and pieces of it, and of course it was the butt of a lot of jokes back when it was coming out.
When it was coming out from ADV, I mean, it was one of those things where they were going to do it in like box sets, and then they backtracked on that in the last second, tried to sell it as singles, no one was buying it, they tried to give away volumes for free, no one wanted the free volumes. It was pretty grim. What were you going to say, Justin?
I asked, I've been following your tweets, mm-hmm. Isn't the show batshit insane?
It's pretty nuts. It's pretty out there. I mean, I think plot-wise, it's not really all that crazy, but the director is, of course, Yoshiyuki Tomino, the creator of Gundam. And right. the man just has a gift for the most idiosyncratic, bizarre character dialogue and behavior. Like, it's curious, because there are scenes where the characters will have this very interesting, you know, natural conversation, and then suddenly they'll just go off on a tangent, and then suddenly someone will, like, make a bad joke, smack the other character and run out of the room.
What?
it's like it's full of these sudden non sequiturs in terms of dialogue and just character behavior. You see some of that in his later productions too. King Gainer is great for that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never really followed his work. Where would you rate this one in terms of his body of work?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Dunbine has got some cachet with mecha fans because it's a sunrise show from the so-called golden age of TV anime, early 80s. And, I mean, I don't know. I think it's definitely better than average. I don't think it really deserves legendary status. I mean, there's a pretty good reason why it didn't spawn the kind of sequels and, you know, legacy that Gundam did. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really have that kind of legs to it. I mean, on the other hand, it did spawn Garzy's wing.
Well, then.
Yes. Thank you.
It's worth its weight in gold.
Yeah, I mean, and also, yeah, the series is well known in North America for being nigh unobtainable in its full release. There are rumors that only around 100 copies of the last two volumes, 11 and 12, were produced by ADV Films. I got them both. One of them came from the fire sales that they were routinely having back in the day before they went out of business for good. Volume 12 I actually found at a Virgin Music store that was going out of business.
Wow.
That's a story I love to tell because the signs all over the store said 50% off, lowest marked price. And I found Volume 12, the hardest to find volume of Dunbine, for $3.99. So I walked out of the store with it for $2.
Wow!
Nice.
Yeah, and another reason why I decided to watch it recently is that with the recent tragic demise of Carl Masek, this series stands as his final major work. And dub-wise, it's actually pretty all right. It's clunky but charming.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm finding a lot of his work is kind of best summed up like that.
Yeah, well, he takes an interesting approach where all of the characters that are pulled into this, you know, magical world of Bison Well from Earth have kind of flat, straight, accentless, quote-unquote, American accents. And the characters in Bison Well all have a range of British Isle accents, which, of course, really means that everyone is either from Dublin or London.
Right.
if you ever wanted to know how Vic Mignogna would sound doing his impression of the Lucky Charms leprechaun, just get a volume of this.
Sweet Jesus.
He plays one of the major characters. He acquits himself pretty well, but yeah, he just sounds goofy.
Oh, so he didn't actually get Europeans to do it. It's all Texas.
They filmed it in Texas.
Well, yeah, hey, yeah, sometimes, you know.
It sounds like one or two of the... It sounded to me, who hears a lot of various British accents watching soccer all the time, that he found a couple of people who lived in the area who did some acting who lived in Britain at one point. But, yeah, for the most part, I think my favorite part about watching the series was whenever the series' heavy Drake Luft was on screen. He's the big bad guy. He's a regional lord who uses the power of aura battlers to try to conquer Bison Well and later on our own world. And he's voiced by Phil Ross, who is ADV's token, like, distinguished older gentleman. He was Space Butler in Excel Saga. If you look up his profile, like, 90% of his roles are grandfather or old man. And the thing is, Drake Luft is cue ball bald. And to me, he looks kind of like Tomino himself, who is also cue ball bald.
Oh, yeah.
And the actor, Phil Ross, gives the character this kind of nice, decrepit Grand Moff Tarkin vibe. So every time Drake Luft is on screen, you know, talking about victory or his allies betraying him, I just picture Yoshiyuki Tomino in 1983 walking around the studio floor just being like, "Those executives thinking they can turn my masterpiece into a toy commercial? I'll show them. I'll have Miyatake design the ugliest toy robots imaginable."
Success.
Yeah, I think he was successful in that endeavor. The aura battlers are pretty weird looking. I mean, that's another aspect of the show. There are tons and tons of these weird aura vehicles. Only a couple of them really have that kind of vibe of being just like, okay, this is a cool robot. Like, the title robot looks kind of neat, and there's another robot that comes in later that's sort of a powered up version of the Dunbine called the Bilbine. And those are pretty cool, but almost everything else just looks kind of weird and not really memorable. It's like there are a whole bunch of things that just look like insectoid hunks of garbage floating in the sky.
You know, just real briefly, like that makes it all the more strange that, remember, Justin, we were in Japan last year and we went to that Toys R Us in Odaiba and there was that stack of dusty old Dunbine toys sitting in the clearance aisle. Man, what were those doing?
Man.
What were those doing there? Then again, they were next to Flavor Flav action figures, so maybe it was just a weird ass Toys R Us, but
right. You know, well, they did do mobile suit and action, like action figure versions of the Dunbine and a couple of other of the suits, so there is some nostalgia for the thing.
Yeah,
I've met Tomino a couple of times, and I always got the impression that this guy, he kept going back to Gundam because it kept being successful, and he really, really wanted to be known for Bison Well and for Dunbine, and that is the one that just he could never get that franchise to stick.
Yeah. I mean, he's quite fond of the novel series, the light novel series that he started the whole thing with, Wings of Reen, and he's tried to get it off the ground over and over again. There was a Wings of Reen OVA series a couple of years ago that came out from Bandai Visual.
It was a very pretty train wreck.
It's absolutely gorgeous, but it's completely incomprehensible. I mean, one of my favorite convention memories of a couple of years ago is I used to run the anime room for a Boston sci-fi convention called Aresia. And, you know, one night at Aresia, I had programmed all six episodes of Wings of Reen at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was just chilling out, just waiting for my relief to come in so I could go off to bed and crash. And right in the middle of the night, about 7 or 8, just, you know, real obvious, they still smell like weed, they got bloodshot eyes, total potheads, come stumbling in with, like, bags of chips and, you know, giant sodas and everything. They all pile into the front row, and they spend, like, over an hour just talking amongst themselves quietly, trying to figure out what the hell is going on screen. And they can't do it.
I would imagine weed would not make that show more intelligible.
Yeah. I might make it a little more interesting. Also, to stay on the subject of giant robots, have you guys seen the commercial release of the series called Raijin-O?
No, but I've been dying to.
Yeah, I just found out about this. Like, I know you guys ran the press release on it back in January when, like, the buzz on it started. Zach, do you know anything about it?
Not a damn thing.
Well, there's an anime company out of St. Louis called Anime Midstream. And they licensed this 1991 super robot series called Raijin-O, or, you know, Zettai Muteki Raijin-O, absolutely invincible Raijin-O, or unmatchable Raijin-O.
Oh, yeah. I actually remember this. The art is similar to Go Gaigar, isn't it?
Yeah. It was kind of a bridge between the original Transformers series and the Brave series that would start a couple of years later. It's actually part of a trilogy called the Eldron Trilogy, or Eldron Trilogy. And it's basically, you know, it's a bunch of kids piloting their cute, brightly colored super robot to save the world. It's not such a bad little series, but it's really obviously for kids. But this company in St. Louis have licensed this series, which I think is like 50 episodes.
And by company, you mean middle-aged IT guy with too much money?
It seems that way. The thing is, they've released the first disc. It is bilingual. There are subtitles, and there is a dubbed version that is made by local amateurs, a whole bunch of which came from the local anime con.
I've been hearing stories about this. Tell me about it.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a good dub exactly, but it's kind of clunky and it has its charms. I mean, it's one of those things that I listened to the dubbed version, and not only did I note the fact that technically it's poor, like it's mixed really badly and strangely, like it's not a proper stereo mix. There, some characters are only in the left channel, some are only in the right channel. I don't know what the hell is going on with that, but that's not something I ordinarily notice. So that's how bad it was. I noticed it right away. The other thing is, you know, the acting is not that great. But at the same time, as I'm listening to the characters, you know, the actors do their reads as the characters, unmistakably, these people are into this. They want to make it work. I'd say my biggest criticism is a problem with a lot of super robot shows in English, which is that, the characters have to get hot-blooded and dispense justice and do a lot of screaming, and they can't do it convincingly in this version. It sounds like they're holding back.
Really? In the dub?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that the famous Prince of Tennis fan dub.
Yeah, where it's like, you know, the characters are they're trying to, you know, do these big dramatic speeches, but they're speaking in what sounds like kind of like a stage whisper.
Right, where they just, it's like they don't want the people in the next room over to hear what they're doing.
Exactly. Yeah, I could totally picture this dub being recorded in like a closet with a bunch of eggshell foam stapled to the walls.
Oh yeah. Wow, that's really weird. I'd like to know more about like exactly what's going on at that because that's such a that's very mom and pop.
I've reached out to the company. I've traded one email with them just to find out when the next disc is coming out. They do think they're going to be able to release it this summer, and I'm going to be talking to them more because there's a story here, and I think it's a very interesting one.
I'm dying to have them on the podcast.
To be honest, this sounds like something where this project is going to fail, and then there will be a documentary about it. Like that's what this feels like to me.
Given the state of the anime market, I don't really see how they could get this entire thing out without losing their shirts on it over and over and over again. At the same time, the one thread on the Anime News Network forum about this series has one of the people involved in the dub saying that the English version is fully funded. So they have the money to make the subtitles in the dub version for the whole series.
But maybe not for replication or anything like that?
Yeah. That's the guess I'd make. It's just like, okay, so you've allocated money to get this produced, but how are you going to get it out to the people? They don't have distribution. Like right. This Anime Midstream company, you can just Google their name. They're pretty easy to find, animemidstream.com. You can get the DVDs from their website using PayPal, but really nowhere else. Wow. And it's the old model of 5 episodes for $25.
You know, Sean Kleckner is one of the easiest guys in the world to deal with. The fact that Right Stuff isn't selling this kind of says it all.
Well, all it really says is that it probably hasn't even occurred to these folks to just, you know, call Sean up and say, hey, can we put your stuff on what's it called? On
Right Stuff. How does that not occur to someone, though?
Well, I mean, they're just enthusiasts. Like, you see this a lot, where it's like, I think the old term is heroic stupidity, where somebody just sort of runs into a situation very well-meaning, 100%, full of conviction, just can't wait to do it, and has absolutely no idea what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about this release is I think Raijin Oh is not a great candidate for this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, for years, for almost the entire time I've been a fan of anime, I've dreamed of the notion of getting a bunch of money together somehow and just, you know, doing the release of an anime series I always wanted to make.
Right.
And it seems like these guys are taking a stab at it, and I have to admire that.
It must have been there's got to be some totally crazy story about how they even got in touch with the people who own the, you know, the Japanese company that owned that show. And wow, yeah.
So Sunrise has had to go through Bandai, and you know that's not that easy of a connection to make
unless somebody
It's Sunrise. The Sunrise logo is on the box. So they had to deal with Sunrise at one point. And which, you know, if they got this pushed through and dealt with Sunrise, I really have to admire them, because I still hear horror stories.
Yeah, yeah, they're like the world's least easy company to deal with.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
Well, okay, yeah.
Well, yeah, there's always Inoki Films.
Right. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your column. Mm-hmm. You're launching your column on Sunday. It's just the Mike Tool Show. Tell people what to expect.
Well, first of all, I have to thank the genius who came up with the title for the column, just because, you know, I had no idea what the hell to call it, and that title works as well as any. The column is going to be about whatever I want it to be about. Yeah. I'm going to let the debut roll on its own without any spoilers, but in the future, I'm going to be discussing such topics as the Island of Misfit Super Robots, the history of anime magazines in English, Anime Sunday School, like all the Japanese animation about Christianity or funded by Christian groups, anime based on the great works of Western literature, that sort of stuff. Also, some more recent stuff, like one column that's coming up is about Lupin the Third Oddities, but gives plenty of time to the new Episode Zero DVD from Discotech. Another one is going to be about Golgo 13, and I'm hoping that one in the fall is going to be about Spice and Wolf to coincide with the home video release of Season 2. That doesn't have a release date yet, so it's probably going to hinge on whenever that thing actually drops.
Now, didn't you do a big Spice and Wolf article for Otaku USA?
Yes, I did. It was actually the cover story for, I think it was either the February or the March issue. That issue, by the way, is the biggest selling issue to date of Otaku USA. So apparently the kids like their Spice and Wolf.
Wow. I would never
or
have guessed
that. Or they just knew I wrote it and, you know, they just couldn't help themselves.
Of course. Of course.
Clearly, yeah.
So I would wager that you find that show as bafflingly odd as we do.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the thing is, on first glance, I looked at it and I was just like, okay, from what I'm reading about this, it's a pretty interesting story. But they got this character, Holo, you know, the wolf girl that they're kind of dangling as otaku bait. But that's uncharitable. She's a pretty interesting character, and it is a pretty interesting story. I mean, my biggest problem with the first season is that, to me, it feels like it's 6 or 7 episodes of a really good series stretched over 13 episodes.
Yeah.
So the pacing's a little off. There's a little bit too much fluff to it. I felt like it could have kind of gone along a lot faster, but I enjoyed it for what it was. I think it's a pretty good show.
Yeah, it always just struck me as incredibly strange that something with a premise like that can be as popular as it is. I mean, it is very popular, you know, for what it is. And it's such an odd premise and a weird execution. We just ran a review of the first volume of the manga version, which apparently relies way more on the fan service aspect than either the show or the novel did. So that's sort of a little bit of a letdown. But yeah.
What great new dubs have you discovered, Justin?
Well, I've just been going through all of the UK dubs that we imported together that you sent me. There's still a few more of those. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I've still got all of the Soryuden, Legend of the Four Kings to send you.
Oh, God. And have you checked out the UK dub yet? There's actually a separate UK dub of Battle Angel.
Yeah, I was supposed to send you that one, but the DVD I sent you was botched, or I didn't send it because it was botched. But yeah, I've got that one as well.
Excellent. Now, I've been slowly going through them. God, the UK dub of the ADV produced UK dub of Street Fighter 2V. What an oddity that is.
Yeah, that's something, isn't it?
Basically, Street Fighter 2V was usually its manga video producing something for the UK only. This time, manga video released it in the US, and ADV released it in the UK, and produced a dub just for the UK market.
Yeah, and the dub was still produced in Texas, so has all the ADV regulars circa 1997.
Yeah, like Brett Weaver as Ryu.
Yep, yeah, it's like John Gremillon or John Swayze or Rob Mungle or whatever as Ken. You know, one of those dudes.
It's kind of a forgettable dub, but, you know, quirky in that, you know, late 90s ADV way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those things that it's, you know, it's not good exactly, but it's kind of persistently watchable. It's
right.
Interesting.
You know, it reminded me why I don't like the show.
Yeah.
The problem is that Ken and Ryu, who are the leads and are meant to be, you know, the guys you get behind, are completely unlikable.
Yeah. They're kind of douchebags, aren't they?
Yeah. I was thoroughly annoyed with them by the end of the second episode. And I'm like, okay, you're these 17-year-old kids sneaking into bars, picking fights. Ryu gets a free pass because, you know, he's a rich kid, or Ken does, rather. And yeah. There's like no consequences for anything. They're just kind of, you know, being thugs.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I don't relate to this. These kids are assholes.
Yeah, they kind of are. I mean, and it's kind of mind-blowing when you think that, yeah, this TV series was directed by Sabato Usugi.
Yeah.
You know, the great man behind Night on the Galactic Railroad and the 70s Jack and the Beanstalk film and you know, so many other classics.
Touch.
It's kind of like, it's kind of like finding out that, oh, the Pink Jacket Lupin series, the one that everyone likes the least, that was directed by Seijun Suzuki, like one of Japan's great Yakuza film directors.
Yeah, everyone's got to put food on the table.
Exactly. One thing I've noticed that I wanted to touch on very briefly, this actually came up in Brian Hansen's Answer Man column. Animax, the Southeast Asian cable channel, has changed its policies pretty recently such that they now show more than 90% of their stuff dubbed in English. There's obviously some existing dubs, but there is a new dub of K-On, for example, and a totally separate Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood dub. Yeah, with, like,
how does it sound?
I can't find it yet because, you know, Funimation, to their credit, are actually pretty bullish about keeping unauthorized versions of the series from being found very easily.
Right.
So, but I've read posts about it. There are apparently all kinds of crazy accents, like Major Armstrong has a Russian accent to make him sound kind of like Zangief, and all of the homunculi have like effete British accents. And wow. You know, obviously, I must hear this. The K-On one isn't as difficult to find. If you run some searches for it, you'll dig it up. I think it's actually pretty charming. It's definitely clumsy. The leads sound a little bit too old, but it's certainly not unwatchable. There's also a separate Area 88 TV dub, which means that I think we've gotten four separate casts for the series, if I'm not mistaken.
Because yeah, like, we didn't had two dubs for the OVAs and now two dubs for the TV.
Well, no, the TV ADV version, they use the same cast for both the OVA and the TV version, but didn't CPM's release of the original OVA have some weirdness where, like, there was a couple of episodes where the dub was supplied by Manga UK and then the rest was dubbed in New York or something like that?
Oh, yeah. The first episode, I think, was Manga UK and it tanked and they bailed on it. Then the second episode was dubbed by Kip Kaplan and Audio Works Group, famous for their indescribably terrible dubs of hentai.
And Garzy's Wing.
You know, I'm still not convinced that was him.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I don't think it's him because Kip is always in his dubs. And I don't hear him in that. He has a really distinctive high-pitched voice.
I see.
And I think that was credited wrong in the DVD. And then they didn't and that tanked too, and so they just didn't even bother dubbing the last episode.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was the worst-selling thing in CPM's catalog.
That's depressing, because I've always loved Area 88. Eclipse Comics put out single-issue versions of it way back in the late 80s, and I read those things religiously.
They weren't bad. I mean, there was a time where the manga was even serialized in Animerica.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing about Area 88, yeah, that's right, Viz and Eclipse teaming up to do that release to pamphlet form. The thing about Area 88 is that came out in English during a time where I would go to the comic store and be like, I like Robotech. This looks like Robotech. I'm going to buy this. And I think that was kind of the whole thinking behind it. But, I mean, for me, it worked. I thought the comics were good. I was very excited to see the OVA. And the OVA is great. You know, if any fans out there, just like, if you want something that you can watch in a couple of hours and it's just really well animated and interesting and intriguing and soul-crushingly depressing, then go and get the Area 88 OVA on DVD from ADV. It's good stuff. One other thing I wanted to mention is I finally got my hands fans on the old Viz Galaxy Express 3.9 dubs, which I'm pretty happy about that.
Are great.
Yeah, yeah. They have Scott McNeil as Captain Harlock. And for my money, he's the finest version of Harlock yet recorded, which is, for me, is saying something just because more than 10 men have played that role in various productions. You know, if you count the Ziv original dub, the parody dub, the Roger Corman Galaxy Express dub, where he sounds like John Wayne, the Hong Kong My Youth in Arcadia dub, the Carl Masek Queen of a Thousand Years dub, the two Galaxy Express 3.9 films, Queen Emeraldus, where he appears for about a second and a half,
DNA sites,
Cosmo Warrior Zero and Gun Frontier, Harlock Saga, and Herlock Endless Odyssey.
Wait a second. Did you have that written down?
The earliest ones I had written down, but like the last five, yeah. I mean, come on, jeez. You have that memorized too, don't you? It's normal.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is why we wanted Mike writing for us.
Yeah.
Well, there's a scene in Area 88 where, you know, one of the characters is completely horrified by all the violence around him, and the main character Shin Kazuma just turns to him and is just like, "You think this is insane? It's a normal day for us." So that's, you know, I leave you with that thought.
All right, man. Well, thanks for calling in. And as we said, this is actually like a normal promotional talk show appearance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm actually here to talk about something that you can read, a new product.
Yeah. So Sunday, that column will go up, and that's a bi-weekly, so you'll be appearing opposite Astro Toy.
Yep.
On every other Sunday. And I'm sure...
That's right. To celebrate that, we're also posting up a new, never-before-seen, unless you were at Otakon last year, Dubs That Time Forgot panel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll go up at the same time.
Oh, really? I was wondering when that was going to make an appearance.
Well, you just sent me those awesome, just a couple months ago. So.
I know, right? Yeah, I only made you wait about 5 or 6 months for them.
Well.
Yeah.
That was early for me.
So this Sunday, if you're into the tool, come to ANN. We've got them. So that'll be good.
Sunday. Exactly. 4 tons of diesel pumping car crushing power.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, man. Thanks a lot.
What's your name, little fella?
All right. Joining us next is Jim. How's it going, Jim?
Going great. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. While we re-record this segment, we got about a third of the way through this, and my internet crapped out. Thanks, Time Warner Cable, and so we're doing this over again. What's on your mind, Jim?
All right. I just kind of wanted to ask you guys, especially since we have Justin here, who seems to kind of be the expert on these sort of things. Old shows, things like. I don't know, Urusei Yatsura, stuff like that. Is it still relevant today, or are they just kind of treasures or relics of a bygone era that were maybe best to move on and forget?
I'd probably say somewhere in between. It depends on the show.
Well, yeah.
Some of it has aged really well. Some of it really, really looks dated and silly. The thing is about that era is that it was the era of the Japanese bubble economy. And so as a result, you had a lot of really experimental work being done. There was a lot of stupid money, as they say, being thrown around. So anyone that could come up with a proposal to make a show, especially for an OVA, probably got a green light and a healthy budget to do so. So you got a lot of crap, most of which is really hard to get these days. And you got some really interesting good stuff by young directors who never really would have gotten a break otherwise. And that doesn't happen today. So there's a bunch of really spectacular inventive shows from that era just waiting to be discovered. And they've mostly been forgotten. Then again, there's a lot of shows that are just really, really flawed. Sifting through them and trying to figure out which ones should still be held up for all to see. That's kind of been what I was doing with Buried Treasure for the last few years.
So here's a question. Is there anything that you think has, from like the 80s and the 90s, that has an undeserved reputation and anything that you think should be appreciated more that's generally, just generally known? The one thing I guess calling it overrated would be not an accurate statement, but I sort of wish Fushigi Yugi would just be fucking completely forgotten and swept under the rug because that show was terrible.
Yeah. That's one of those shows that was really important to the fans when it came out, but since then I think time has expose just how flawed it is. I think another one like that, and I'm going to get raked over the coals for saying this, is Bubblegum Crisis.
Oh, I'm with you on that. Yeah. Well, on it being overrated?
Well, see, here's the thing. When it came out, it was mind-boggling and awesome. Since then, it's really, really aged pretty poorly. What was once edgy now looks just kind of trite and cheesy. And the pop music isn't doing it any favors.
Oh, yeah. It's so, like, 1987, the anime, you know, like, super 80s. And, like, all the good ideas it had have since been done way better. Going back and revisiting it, it totally feels just like, wow, this thing is best left in the trunk in the attic, you know?
It doesn't really have anything all that edgy to say. It's just kind of a fairly standard cyberpunk yarn.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but at the time it was like, whoa, sexy chicks destroying robots. Like, oh my God, holy shit, this is the future. And now it's like,
oh man, if I saw this in 1990 and I didn't see it that long after, I would have been, holy crap, this is the best thing ever. And, you know, if this was one of my formative anime, I would still remember it very fondly. But actually, a Japanese Blu-ray came out of this, and I saw it.
Did it? Wow.
And oh my God.
That good?
No. The opposite. It looks like half the cells looked like they were drawn with someone's left hand and painted in by their 5-year-old brother.
It's really sloppy. Is it really that sloppy? Because I don't remember that show being all that sloppy. It always, in my head, and I haven't seen it in probably a decade, it had decent animation for the time.
It did have decent animation for the time. For the time, if you're watching it in standard definition on a blurry from a blurry old master or a Laserdisc. Now, if with every line of paint is pristine and you can see every little mistake where the colorist didn't get right within the lines, and you can see every scuff of the cell, it looks pretty rough.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever. I have no desire to ever revisit that show. I would actually probably say I would call Urusei Yatsura, the show anyway, probably underrated. I think it is just a sitcom. It's just a Rumiko Takahashi sitcom, but it was it was pretty well done for its time. It was kind of funny. It had good characters, and it's, you know, nobody watches it anymore. No one really gives a shit about Lem anymore.
I guess except for me.
except for you, yes. Except for you. But, you know, that's one of those ones that I think is still entertaining. Justin, I think you're not a fan of that particular series.
I'm not, but I fully admit that I've probably not given it a proper chance. The first season or so, that's a slog for me to get through, and I'm told it picks up after that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't start watching. I picked it up like right in the middle of the show because I'd read the comics, and the comics are way better and way funnier. Just because the Rumiko Takahashi's gift is character expression, and she's really good at making funny character expressions, and that's why the comics work so well. Like the interaction between what's the lead character's name?
Ataru
and Mendo. Mendo is a really funny character in the comics, and I didn't think he was all that funny on the show. I guess it just didn't really quite translate that well. But I mean, that's a good, solid sitcom series that I think people should go back and give it a shot. Even though it looks old, it looks like 1980s Takahashi, whose style has
weird,
not evolved.
Because I feel like I'm I find that weird or not weird that older looking shows surprisingly charming in a way. Like that's why I guess I never really understood the aversion to the Genion releases of Lupin the Third, besides the actual way it was released. But the show itself, I always kind of enjoyed the way it looked in kind of a throwbacky sort of way.
Yeah, well, there's stuff from the 80s that has held up, and there's stuff that hasn't. I mean, you know, it all depends on how it was originally drawn and how well that aged, you know?
Yeah.
I think the tough part with making Lupin stick, I mean, and a lot of 80s anime, frankly, is the younger generation that makes up most of anime fandom at this point, they see the anime world, and certainly I did when I was that age, as kind of this escapist fantasy, sort of like Final Fantasy land, where mm-hmm. everyone is beautiful and you just kind of want to project yourself into that world. I don't want to live in the world of Lupin. I don't think anyone wants to live in the world of Lupin. Then everyone has to have those weird hands with lots of hair on them and you know.
They're all knuckly.
Yeah. And,
y'all
and,
got rickets. You know,
no one wants to look like Lupin or Zenigata. And no one really wants to particularly be any of those people. They're kind of, you know, frankly, scummy people.
Yeah.
So I don't think that the sort of narrative that those shows had really fit into the sort of attitudes that anime fandom currently has, which doesn't mean they're bad. In fact, some of them are really, really freaking amazing. And I would probably give my left testicle if more people would watch Cagliostro.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think you would actually do that, but okay.
You're not taking me up on this offer.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of other sort of overrated oldies that have just sort of stuck around. I mean, I look back at what got me into anime now, and, you know, obviously I'm not a fan of that stuff anymore. I can't watch it. It's not even nostalgic for me, which is kind of weird because I'm still nostalgic for movies I liked when I was a kid, but an anime, for whatever reason, doesn't inspire it. I'm not nostalgic for Tenchi or Slayers. I go back and try and watch those shows, and they're pretty bad. So, I don't know. I don't know what that is. Is nostalgia a factor for you, Justin, or when you look back, do you really only look for quality?
I definitely get nostalgic over some of my formative anime, but I think I had a lot better formative anime than you did.
Probably. I mean,
Project Aiko and Dominion Tank Police are still pretty cool today. Tenchi is pretty rough by anyone's standards, and Slayer is, oh man, that show, I don't know how anyone got through that.
Well, I own all that one too.
Sorry, we're not judging you, dude. We're not judging.
No, hey, I admit, like I said, I have weird and sometimes quasi terrible taste in anime. Not saying this, I think I'm the only person who probably owns all of the Genion, fighting Hajime no Ippo release.
Hey, that's not a bad show, nor
no,
is
no,
it.
No, I love that show, but I also have all the Slayers ones, and just bought, Bubblegum Crisis. First time I saw that was about a year ago, and then I don't know if either of you ever seen Golden Boy. But that's a really bad show that I have a weird...
Golden Boy is not a bad show. It's a freaking awesome show.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only person who thinks that, but...
who says it's a bad show? I will punch them. I will fight them.
Again, no, you won't.
what do you
now, that one you can take me up on.
You know what? It just occurred to me, one show that I am nostalgic for that has really held up, Escaflowne. That was a formative one for me. And Evangelion. It's
that
the same
is
way.
True.
Yeah, those have held up really well, and I got into anime watching. Those were right around the same time as Tenchi and Slayer, so, you know, I guess just what I'm enthusiastic for has changed. That's all. I think that's,
yeah, I'll give you that.
That's the chief.
The thing is, everything from the 80s now has been kind of swept under the carpet to such an extent now. I mean, most of it's not even in print anymore, that it's hard to really say any of it is overrated because most of it's just gone.
Yeah, I think Bubblegum Crisis is probably the best example because that's the only one I know that old-timers will still point to and say, oh, man, remember that? That was so great. It's like, no, it wasn't.
Now, were a lot of the Yoshiaki Kawajiri OVAs and movies from the 90s, not 80s? I'm kind of drawing a blank on those right now.
They were from right in the middle, like 89, 90, 91.
Because I still love Wicked City.
Wicked City holds up great. Actually, I was just revisiting those a couple days ago. Wicked City holds up great. It's actually pretty smart. It looks phenomenal. There was a new transfer done in Japan that looks way better than the Urban Vision DVD, and it's still just spectacular to watch. Demon City Shinjuku looks amazing and is retarded.
Well, yeah. The one that I was the one show I think has the best CG that's held up would have to be Golgo 13 the Professional. Those helicopters look as good today as they must have looked back when that first came out.
No, they don't. Those helicopters look like something from a Sega CD game.
I showed a friend of mine that about a month ago, and he was really into the show up until those helicopters came on, and he just starts screaming, What? Why would you do that? There was no reason to do this. Why would you do that?
Yeah, those helicopters are about on the same level as the CG opening of the old Spielberg TV show Amazing Stories, with like the random skulls flying by and the disembodied knight armor fighting with a sword. It's very, oh, this technology isn't there yet, but think of what the future holds.
I mean, did that stuff ever actually look good?
It looked awesome when I was 9.
Okay.
Yeah. So did that CG commercial with the robot lady talking about food in cans.
Oh, man. I remember that. Holy crap. Well, actually, so you're a pretty unique guy then. If you've only been in anime for 6 years and you're now digging into stuff from the 80s, I mean, I don't think a lot of newer fans, you know, from the last 5-6 years have started that yet, have started going back and digging through the old stuff. What got you interested in it?
I'm not really sure. I mean, the first thing that I ever probably really got into, I mean, when I was really young, Saturday morning, I mean, Dragon Ball was still running, and I caught the off episode, but it wasn't something that really kind of pulled me in. The show that really kind of pulled me in and sold me was Cowboy Bebop. Yeah. I started picking that up when I was still back in high school, and I don't know how I started spinning out into older shows. I just looked up stuff, and I guess I kind of like knowing where everything came from to kind of understand where we are now. If that makes any form of sense.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I mean, I saw stuff with, Takahashi, as we were talking about earlier, a good example. Back in college, my roommate's girlfriend liked Inuyasha, so I caught that one. Enjoyed it at least a little bit in the beginning for kind of what it was, which was meh. And then went back into Ranma, and I really liked Ranma. And then Urusei Yatsura, I kind of like at least initially a little bit more than I enjoyed One Half, so...
With Ranma,
Ranma is cute, but boy, that shit gets old.
I think I lost it right around the time where it was martial arts tea ceremony. That one always kind of throws me.
The problem with Ranma is that it has one season's worth of jokes, but it goes on for 7 seasons or whatever. You get those same 15 jokes 158 times or whatever, and it gets so tiresome. I don't know. I actually don't think I know anyone who's legitimately sat down and watched the entire run of the show.
I've made it like four seasons in, and then I just stop.
Just can't take it anymore.
I've actually made, and I've made the attempt from the beginning a couple of times. I've plowed through like the first couple of seasons more than once, and you just can't go any. It's a brick wall. I just run into it, and it's done.
The movies suck too. I mean. They literally have the same plot as Super Mario Brothers.
One of my problems with some of these longer shows like that is when they change a. In this case, I watch it dubbed. When I saw the when I get to the point where they change a voice actor around the beginning of the 4th or 5th season, it just really takes me out at that point. It's why I have a hard time watching as much as I love Slayers, watching the OVAs or movies without Lisa Ortiz. I just, for whatever reason, whoever I hear it for first is the only person who sounds right to me. If that makes any sense?
Yeah. I get it.
Yeah. That happened a lot in the dub world, especially with Ranma. I think the dub of that show was produced over a longer period of time than the show itself.
I could see that.
Mizune Koku was like that, too.
You know, all this has got me really thinking. Rumiko Takahashi has not grown as an artist at all, like through her entire career. She just kind of mixes the same 4 or 5 elements together, you know, puts dog ears on it or an apron on it and calls it something else. I mean, Maison Ikoku is sort of a sting singular work, but man, just thinking about it, it's like, man, the difference, like Ranma and Inuyasha, this stuff is, ugh. Maybe, I guess I'm just not that big a fan of hers, but Justin, I never really put a pin on what your take on her was.
She's all over the place for me. I mean, some of her stuff holds up really, really well, and others are just like, really? This is all you got? She repeats herself a lot. But hey, you know, who might have complained? The woman is, you know, indescribably rich at this point, so
yeah, exactly, more power to her, I guess. I haven't even looked at the most recent thing. whatever that.
I couldn't even do Inuyasha. Just like, okay, I know exactly where this is going.
But I think she's actually gotten worse with time. Not worse, but I think these stories have not in. I think her earlier works were better than her later ones by a pretty fair degree.
Well, as is true, I think this is a very familiar anecdote for many male nerds. I've seen a lot of Inuyasha because I was dating a girl at the time who liked it a lot. And so I got stuck watching. I saw most of that show because I was dating somebody who liked it. And I hear that anecdote that's very common. Apparently that's a very common experience. And the way a lot of dudes watched Inuyasha. There's another forgotten one, but I guess it came back recently. Okay, man. Well, that was a really great discussion. I'm glad that turned out the way it did. Thanks a lot for listening, and thanks for coming on the show.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, great Gazoo, I command you to make yourself known.
I can't, dum-dum. I told you nobody but you could see or hear me.
Okay, we're back, and technically, this is a returning guest. Erin Dearden joins us. She was on the first call-out. Or rather, she was supposed to be on the first call out, but I screwed up the audio and lost it. And so now we have her back. Welcome back to the show, Erin.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So what's on your mind? What's going on?
Well, I'm in the midst of preparing for a convention that's happening in Western Canada this weekend, Odafest. That's happening in Calgary, Alberta. I'll be running a few panels at it, and hopefully it'll be a blast.
What kind of panels do you run?
I tend to run three game shows, two versions of Anime Name That Tune, the Anime Match Game, plus two panels on anime directors, one on Utena, the Revolutionary Girl Utena, and one on, what's the other one? Anime Openings and Closings.
Jeez, that's a full schedule.
Yes. First time I've done so many panels.
What's your attendance like? How does that usually go for you?
Last year, I think we had about 4,500 people, I think. I could be wrong. I'd need to look up the data again.
Right, right. And at your panel specifically, like, how does a Nutella panel, for example, do in 2010, or 2009, mm-hmm. rather?
Well, this will be the first year for the Utena panel, so we're really not sure. I imagine most people in the area have not seen the show, so I would think that not too many, but I think enough to justify having it.
Yeah, I was going to say, that show's been out of print for a while now. I mean, I wonder how much fandom it still has.
Well, it seems to be getting a slight surge from what I've seen around fandom communities anyway. Not a whole lot, but more than it's been anyway.
You know, it's funny when shows just fade. Like, that was a big deal, like, 7 or 8 years ago. And now it just seems to have completely faded in terms of popularity, kind of like Sailor Moon. And I wonder if that's directly related to availability, do you think?
Probably. Also because those DVDs were just not very good. The first ones, anyway.
Not the latter ones, either.
Yeah,
I know, I worked
ones
on them.
Were slightly better, but yeah.
Yeah, I was actually on one of the guys that worked on those, and the company that we used to author them didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, I will at least be glad that the subtitles weren't burned into the screen anymore and that they became more readable, but other than that, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay. All is forgiven.
But I wonder about that, because in this day and age, like now, something like Sailor Moon feels completely irrelevant. And maybe that's just my personal feeling on it, but you don't hear anybody even mentioning it anymore. And I don't know if that's because they haven't revived it in a long time, or it's well, I know the creator's a nutbag. but same goes sort of for Utena. Now, here's a quick question before we get back to the conventions.
Yep.
Would you ever actually want to see a remake of that show? Utena.
Depends on what kind of remake it would be, I would say. If it was like the Utena movie, I would like to see a remake with that kind of art style, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much with the razor blade incest.
Yeah.
I would say I would like to see a remake with Ikuhara returning, but with having similar restraints that he had during the TV series. Because I think a lot of what made Utena great was the creativity that they were dealing with, having such a low budget, or with the kind of content they could put on TV.
Right.
It still had incest.
Interesting ways to work around things.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, say again?
It still had incest.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been thinking about that lately. Like, what would I like to see remade? And I think that show, especially because that was animated by Softex, wasn't it?
Yeah,
they're so kind of awful. Like, the show had moments of good animation, but overall, it kind of looked pretty cruddy.
Yeah, it was pretty clear they had to save up their budget big time to animate the most important parts.
Yeah, that happens pretty often.
Episode 36, near the end, just looked like half the people looked like aliens from outer space.
Well, Softex always had a problem keeping their characters on model.
Like, yeah,
they were legendary for it. I mean, remember Lost Universe?
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. Like, the eyes are in completely different places on their head from one frame to the next. I mean, it's so junky. So I guess I'd like to see someone go back and retackle that material. Not only that, I think it's still really, really a relevant story, a relevant and interesting take on all that stuff. I mean, I loved that show, so I'm biased, but I really think a remake would be good. What do you think about in terms of remakes, Justin?
I would love to see a remake of Arslan, Heroic Legend of Arslan, as something more cohesive.
Oh, yeah?
Because that was a long, epic series of books that the anime just kind of, it started off really strong in the first movie, and then they lost budget, and then years went by, and then they crapped out a few more episodes as OAVAs, and then a few more years went by, and they crapped out two last ones, and then just pinched it off. Just to use a really flattering metaphor.
Right. Yes, thank you for that.
And it's a great story, beautiful story, and it could really be redone as like a fantastic 12-episode series.
Yeah, I've never seen that. Yet another thing I've never seen that we're talking about.
I'm going to have to give you a copy of that. That's not optional.
It's supposed to be really good, right?
The first movie is one of my favorite pieces of animation ever.
Shit, really?
Yeah.
Now I guess I have to see it.
Yeah, I've never seen it myself.
I really have no excuse. I've been a fan for way too long to not have seen that.
Yeah. So many old titles that I feel like I ought to have seen, but just have never gotten around to.
Yeah, yeah. Going back to the convention panels, I'm always sort of mystified by the game shows. It's just, you just take like a television format and change it around so it's all about anime, right? It's not like it's not dramatically different from regular match game.
Yeah, more or less. Well, the match game anyway, except maybe slightly more suggestive than even the regular match game.
Oh, is it saucy?
Yeah, see, that's a late night event.
Oh, okay.
I guess the Name That Tune game wouldn't be quite so close to the original Name That Tune, just because there aren't so many pointless mini games.
Right. Yeah. And did those panels? I mean, you sound like you've run those before.
Yeah, I've run Name That Tune for several years now.
In terms of attendance, how does that do? Like, do you get a lot of people in the room?
That's actually one of our con's most popular events now. It's always well attended.
Really? Wow. So how long have you been going to conventions?
Probably about 10 or 11 years now at this point. 10 years, I guess, yeah.
Have they changed at all in your view?
Well, it's hard to say just because I've hardly been to any of the really big cons. Like, last year was my very first time going to Otakon.
Oh, okay.
And besides that, the only ones I've really been to are these Western Canadian mid-sized anime conventions like Animethon and Otafest. And they have certainly gotten bigger, but they haven't really necessarily increase their scope a lot. Like, they still get a lot of the same guests, maybe a couple of bigger North American voice actors here or there. Nobody's really gotten a Japanese guest in there at any point.
Yeah, I think the only cons that get actual Japanese guests are in a major coastal city, or it's like Ikuhara, where he just happens to be in Wisconsin that weekend.
Yep.
Now, I don't know anything about Canadian anime conventions, but I'm curious about con attendee behavior. Is it the same? I mean, you said you went to Otakon last year. Surely you noticed that most of the conventions seems to be about people screaming internet memes at the top of their lungs in the middle of the hall.
God, I thought I would get sick of the game at some point, but never that quickly.
Yeah. God, I heard some horror stories about Anime Boston this year being just a complete nightmare in terms of that stuff. Like, it's gotten so far out of hand that now they're talking about, you know, outlawing it. Do you have those problems at Canadian cons? In my head, Canadians are all really pleasantly polite, nice people that, you know, offer you syrup or whatever when you come in.
They're like white Japanese people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's it like?
Well, I can't say that there aren't those problems. Like, there's certainly hyper fangirls all over. I would like to say that Otafest attendance tends to run pretty young, like late junior high to high school is the main average attendance, I'd say. But it seems to keep itself fairly well in check, at least compared to some of the shenanigans I saw going on at Otakon.
Yeah.
Man, can't wait to have Jim on.
A lot more people are familiar with the staff at Otafest, I believe. There's more of a sense of community there, I guess.
Right, right, exactly. How much do you wind up having to sort of innovate? Because a lot of these conventions, I notice it's kind of pretty much the same thing every year. It doesn't really change that much. Is it because it only happens once a year where it's like, well, you know, everyone had a good time last year, so why fix what isn't broken? Or do you ever feel really compelled to like, okay, what can I do that's totally different that these people haven't seen before?
Well, I'm of the opinion that this will at least be the last year that we are hosting the con at a university. It's been a university con since its inception. And I think it's finally getting big enough that we'll make the big switch to a convention center. Mm-hmm. Probably the Roundup Center down in Calgary, if anybody's ever been there. Can't say that for sure, but let's see what else here. Not much is coming to mind, because Otafest is, like I said, a fairly well-conducted convention. I would say there's more to fix with a convention like Animathon, which has been having quite a few staff and organizational problems as of the past few years.
Really?
That's in Edmonton.
Huh. See, that always seems to be the problem with these with fan-run cons, is that eventually they seem to kind of implode.
Grow to a certain size, and then the volunteer staff just can't manage it anymore, and it just turns into this giant mess, and everyone has a terrible time 1 year, and then everyone just kind of walks away from it.
Yeah, what I've heard about Animathon is basically just that nobody wants to be staff anymore, and they can't get nearly enough volunteers, and you can really tell things just aren't going well when you attend the actual convention.
It's such a thankless job.
Yeah.
I mean, the one year I was really working my butt off on Big Apple Anime Fest, it was long nights. It was, you know, 24 hours a day work, and if that hadn't been my full-time job, I probably would have gotten fired.
Yeah, I'm actually quite impressed at how the Otafest staff seem to handle it, because they put in so much work, and yet they seem to have this endless optimism about them, even after so many years of running the convention.
Well, I guess when you don't, like, because I certainly have never even thought about volunteering at an anime convention, mostly because I immediately started attending as press after my first trip to AX, in 1999. So it was never really an option for me, but it just never even occurred to me like, you know what? I think I'm going to spend all of my free time figuring out which Nintendo games to have in the arcade. It just seems so utterly thankless. And yet I know hardworking people like Jim, from Otakon, who we're going to have on the show, next month. He puts so much of his life into it, and at the end of the day, it's a convention center full of screaming teenagers. Like, I don't understand the satisfaction.
They're happy screaming teenagers. I think True. That's part of it. The part of the satisfaction is just seeing people have a good time, I think.
Right.
Well, I love the aspect of just putting on a good show.
Yeah, no, my point was that if you don't have that burning passion for it, which I clearly don't have and don't understand, you wouldn't be able to do it. So those people really, I mean, my hat is off to them for, you know, having that passion. Because very few of these conventions, outside of like Reed or San Diego, they don't really have a full-time staff. It's just fans who like doing it, right?
I guess technically AX will now.
AX now, yeah. Well, AX has changed completely.
Right, now that it's not volunteer at all.
Yeah, they lost all of their volunteer staff. What motivates you to do the panels? Is it just for fun, like Justin said, just to put on a good show?
For the game shows, certainly. Part of my enjoyment is just that I'm such a huge anime nerd, or anime music nerd particularly, right, that I want to, well, share my knowledge, share my music, and share the enjoyment that I get out of it with people. And the anime match game's sort of similar, except maybe less anime-focused. That one's more just, let's have a good time at night sort of thing.
Right.
Let's see. For the panels this year that I'm doing would probably be more discussion-based, and that's because, like I said, the attendance of Otafest tends to run a little younger, and I feel that maybe they might do well to learn a bit more about their roots, more or less.
Right.
That's so you're going to focus on old stuff.
Yeah, not so much old stuff, but just, like, histories of things. Like, the director panels I'm doing, one is just on great directors in general, and one is the up-and-coming directors I'd see on the horizon.
Like who?
Like Mamoru Hosoda and Masahiro Ando and Hiroyuki Imaishi.
Right.
Makoto Shinkai, those sort of people.
And as far as the older guard, who from that?
Sorry? Oh, from the older... standards, Miyazaki, Takahata, Tomino, Shinichi Watanabe, Kawajiri.
Oh my god, Shinichi Watanabe is old guard.
Yes, it's kind of weird to think about, but thankfully Shinichi Watanabe only gets really one slide on my show, and it's a picture of him showing his crotch.
Right.
Well, thank God for
that. Like, yeah, that's that guy. Let's move on.
Right. You know, I wouldn't call Shinkai up and coming. I'd say that guy already peaked. Like,
yeah, I'm not going to spend too much time on him because a lot of people already know who he is.
Yeah, the guy has a very compelling 30 minutes in him that has been stretched out for his entire filmography.
Three or four films.
I'm much more interested to talk about Hosoda, I think, just because he's got two main films out so far and an interesting kind of backstory in those sort of One Piece Digimon films that he did.
Yeah, that's really true. And that Digimon film he did is very, very similar to Summer Wars.
Much better than it had any right to be.
Yeah, totally.
You actually saw that?
Yeah, I have a copy.
Oh.
Well, I saw the cut-down version they put in the English Digimon movie anyway.
Right. It's a lot like Summer Wars.
How so?
I would go as far as to say the story is a proto-Summer Wars in the way that parts of Paranoia Agent are a proto-Paprika.
Really?
Yep.
In a Digimon movie, you say?
In a Digimon movie.
Yeah, so the big climax does take place inside the computer in the white background with the flowing colorful images and wires and whatnot.
Yep.
So you could say that he digivolved as a director.
Hosoda digivolved too. Miyazaki.
Oh, God. No, let's hope not.
I'd like to ask you about your name that anime tune. Mm-hmm. What do kids recognize these days, and what is obscure to them now?
I think I've become kind of an expert on that at this point. It's actually gotten to the point where I run two versions of Name That Tune. One is the regular version that's mainly stuff from your standard Shonen Jump stuff like Bleach, Naruto, Hitman Reborn, and new stuff like K-On! And Kanagi, whatever it is.
The easy stuff for the kids.
Yeah, the easy stuff for the kids. Although there's some hard stuff thrown in just to throw them off, and the people who actually know their stuff do end up winning. But there's also the other version, the Deluxe Advanced Monster Edition, or the Dame Edition, as I call it.
Where here's a MIDI of a random background theme from Touch.
Or the Italian version of Ginga Senpu Briger or something.
Holy Jesus. God, I would have failed so hard.
There's a separate way to run that game, though, and that's just, if nobody knows what song it is, I give out bonus points to the person who can give the most interesting description of what they think that show is about.
Oh, that's cool. I like that. That's really that's really innovative. That's really cool.
Yeah, actually, it's turned into one of our most popular casual game shows because of that.
Wow. That sounds like fun.
Yeah. Not that I would actually go to one of those things at a convention.
Hey, I would. I totally would.
I don't know. Our cosplay director is a big fan of it.
Just kidding. Okay, well, awesome. So that convention is when?
This weekend, which is Victoria Day weekend in Canada, May 21st to 23rd.
Victoria Day. Okay.
Don't you know, Zach?
No. I know one Canadian holiday. Actually, no, two, because our boss is Canadian, and he always takes Canadian Thanksgiving off, which is in, like, September or something like that, right?
October.
Yeah, see, there you go. I guess I don't know. More than one.
We're Americans. We are the center of our own universe.
Yeah, exactly. And are you planning on attending any U.S. cons this year?
I'm going to go back to Otakon, definitely. I wouldn't miss Homemade Kazoku for the world. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of maybe going to the Penny Arcade Expo West again, but that depends on financial situation.
Have you been to that before?
Yeah, I went once in 2008. That was really great, actually.
Was it fun? I've always thought about going to that.
Sorry?
I've always thought about going to one of those, but I never put it in my travel budget.
It's probably one of the smoothest run conventions I've ever been to. Big conventions, anyway.
Wow. So the elevator only breaks down four times?
Yeah, well, the escalators, anyway. Actually, the escalators were working a surprising amount of the time.
Well, amazing. Okay, dude. Well, thanks for coming on and chatting with us. And thanks for being on the show.
All right, let's hope the audio doesn't get lost this time.
Yes, I will make sure that I save it right now.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
You doubt the powers of the great Kazoo? Take that! And that!
Okay, we're back. My next guest, or caller, or whatever you want to call it, is Lisa Patillo, our newest critic, our newest manga critic at Anime News Network. You may have seen her review of Spice and Wolf, and we just posted the first volume of My Girlfriend is a Geek. Also the creator and author at Curiosity.com, spelled with a K and a dash, so have fun figuring that out. Thanks for being on, Lisa.
Oh, no problem. It's great to be on here. You know, long-time listener and first-time participant.
I don't think you can be a long-time listener. We've only been around for about 6 months.
Well, you're the only podcast I ever listened to and ever have, so that's a long time for me.
That's very kind. Thank you very much for listening. So, obviously, we're having you on to talk about the manga industry imploding, basically, over the last couple of weeks. What's your take on it? So, I guess we should sort of go down everything that's happened. First, we saw Viz cut 60% of their workforce, which was down, which, according to all of my sources, is down to the bone. The people that are left there, there's not many people left, and the people that are left are working, you know, suddenly have three jobs to do, which is pretty dire. And then we saw CMX fold, and then GoCombi went away. So what's your take? What do you think is happening? Is this the apocalypse, or what's up?
Well, I definitely wouldn't say it's the apocalypse, though with all that's been happening, it's pretty easy to look at it that way. I mean, you can follow this unfortunate trend back a couple months. I mean, first you had Aurora Publishing, where people were saying it was up for sale and it's gone. You had GoCombi disappearing. You had Yen Press pulling the printing plug on Yen Plus.
Yeah.
And then Viz. And then now CMX, which seems like it just kind of came out of absolute nowhere. So I think that was just kind of, you know, the cherry on the really bad cake of manga industry in the last couple months.
Yeah. You know, it's now with CMX, and obviously this stuff isn't on my radar as much as it's on yours. So tell me if this perception is incorrect, but they were very quiet. They didn't have any big hits. I never really heard people talking very much about their titles except for like one or two. And like, I was kind of surprised they were still around anyway. Is that accurate? What was your take on that whole thing? You mentioned it was a huge surprise, but to me it felt like they were still publishing.
Well, I guess the interesting part, at least the way I saw it about CMX being a surprise, one, because, I guess it kind of encompasses it all. No one really talked about CMX. You know, CMX's titles were things that were really well loved by a very particular group of people. It got so little advertising that very few people really even knew about it. And like you said, even knew it still published. And because there was so little talk about it, it wasn't like with, you know, every other company, Tokyopop, even Aurora Publishing, GoCombi, there wasn't that chatter, that discussion on what's selling well, what's not, what's going on. Just no one was talking about it at all. And I think that kind of put people in a lull of, I guess, false security. They just kind of assumed if they heard nothing, then there was nothing to hear. And, you know, life would keep going on as normal. So I guess it was a bit of a wake-up call when suddenly DC Comics turns around and pulled the plug. On one hand, it's probably the first time, aside from Viz, that we've gotten a solid, here's what's going on, here's the facts. Well, as much as you could consider what they gave us facts. But, you know, it's definitive. It's not a publisher just kind of coasting into obscurity until it's gone and someone notices.
Right, right. Now, I heard one of the things that sort of always baffled me was CMX's title selection. Now, I know the fans, you know, the super hardcore fans love their stuff, but it was so not mainstream. It was like lots of old shoujo, right?
Oh, yeah. It was very old shoujo. I mean, their most popular series, from what I hear people talk about, and even, you know, polls and all that going on now, what people are going to miss, things like Swan. Yeah. I might mangle this name when I say try to say it from Eroshia with Love.
I think it's is it Eroshia or Eroika?
Eroika. Like right. I said, I probably mangled it.
Who cares?
But yeah, titles like that, I mean, they're old school. And they have a lot of titles that, I mean, I'll admit I have only owned a handful of CMX manga over the years. It was so you could barely find it here. Randomly, the local comic store would get it in, but that was about it. And about literally a week before CMX you know, made this announcement, I came into possession between buying and being sent it about 35 CMX books, and I read them all in about a week, and I adored the majority of them. And a lot of them are, you know, really old titles, and what makes them sort of endearing is because you would not see these titles picked up by Viz. You would not see these picked up by Del Rey or Tokyo Pop. And so I can definitely see the charm in that. At the same time, I can also see why people would completely overlook this really retro-looking art style when they see it next to, you know, Big Shiny or Gerudo or any of the newer things coming out.
Right. Now, one of the issues with CMX, from what I've been told, is that DC Comics would basically force Diamond, their comic book buyers, comic book shops, they would force them to stock, you know, 5 or 6 copies of some obscure old shoujo title in order to get their DC fulfillment. You know, they really kind of crammed it down the comic book publisher, comic book store's throats. And that was they were heavily criticized for doing that. It's also one of the reasons you don't really find a lot of their books in, like, Borders or Barnes & Noble or any other major book chain. At least that's what I was told, and those books didn't sell through, like, at all. So I heard that was an issue. I don't know what the distribution's like in Canada, but that's sort of what happened here. So some of these titles, it sounds like maybe if they weren't any of those other publishers you mentioned, maybe Vertical, you think, might swoop in and pick up a couple of these?
I think for some of them, and a company like Vertical could definitely take them, like maybe things like Swan, the more, I guess, you know, the classier, older titles.
Yeah.
There's some of them where, you know, I don't think I could, unfortunately, see them being picked up by anyone. I mean, like, what's one of them? I got King of Cards. It's done by Makoto Tateno, who is more known for doing her yaoi. Mm-hmm. And here it is, like, it's basically shoujo Yu-Gi-Oh, like, to a T. I don't know where this would fit in anyone's catalog, but, I mean, I found it far too addicting for being shoujo Yu-Gi-Oh. but... Yeah, you could pick apart CMX. Like, they've got really violent stuff, and then they've got things like King of Cards, and they've got things like Gone, absolutely terrifying dinosaur with no words in the whole thing.
yeah. So didn't Gone?
Maybe that's one Vertical could do. They could take the terrifying dinosaur and package him up.
I thought that was a Dark Horse title for some reason. Didn't they publish a couple of Gone books?
I'm not sure. I think Dark Horse is probably the one I know the absolute least about, probably in terms of manga, but CMX is the one, to my knowledge, who did Gone, and I have the first 4 volumes of it by them.
Yeah, Dark Horse, I guess the only reason I'm familiar with Dark Horse's work is because they publish virtually every manga title I follow. Hellsing, Berserk, Gantz, you know, that kind of thing. but so, the other people that went away are GoKami. Now, I hadn't heard anything from those people in months and months and months and months, probably years, and I mean, it was just learning of their demise was kind of a death rattle. What in the manga sphere, you know, the manga blogosphere, what was the reaction to that? Did anyone really kick up a fuss, or was it just like, here's more bad news?
I definitely wouldn't say anyone kicked up a fuss. It was one of those things where everybody just kind of let out a collective sigh and, you know, sad face all around. But no one was really surprised. They haven't released a book since, I believe, October of 2009.
Okay.
So to only really have the website and the forums go down and to hear some sort of definitive answer, here we are in what, May of 2010. Mm-hmm. I think there was a long silent pause that kind of gave people a pretty good idea of what was coming.
So in your opinion, did GoKami publish anything that was people should run out and snap up before it, you know, it's so far out of print and so hard to find that you can't get it anymore?
Well, let me see, GoKami. Take a look at my shelf here. I mean, they had a bunch of really, you know, good series. I don't know if I'd say people should, like, you know, can't think of anything they should really run out and, like, you know, you really need to have this. I mean, After School Nightmare, that was a really good one. I have my own issues with the end of the series, but it got a lot of, you know, fanfare and people talking about it for a reason. Really good psychological story. Mm-hmm. Cantarella was a good one from Yuhaguri. Big fan base here, so.
Yeah, right.
And more recently, they had their 07 Ghost, which seemed to have a bit of a following going for it. And I think it was probably GoKami's, at least one of their most successful series, and definitely the most successful series they had just before they stopped putting books out.
Yeah, just last year at Anime Expo, they had a huge banner in the exhibit hall for that. And then that really, really crappy anime came out.
Yeah, I don't know if that helped or hurt them.
God, I hated that anime. Okay, so actually, same question for CMX. I mean, you mentioned a couple of titles, but what should people get before they can't anymore?
You know, really what I'd say to do for CMX is to start, go to their website and see what they have. CMX's website was actually one of the better ones for listing all their titles, showing all the cover thumbnails, and even having preview pages. But there's so much diversity. I mean, I could sit here and keep giving recommendations, but I think, you know, everyone from all ages and no matter what genre you like could find something. So it's hard to say, you know, everyone should collectively all go out and get blah. But everyone should definitely go check out the library. They probably publish a lot more than they thought.
Okay, cool. now with Viz, I mean, what do you think that's going to mean for that company? So, I mean, do you think quality is going to go down? I mean, do you think they should cut their output? Because, I mean, they release, what, 33 books a month or something like that?
I can't really speak to if their quality is going to go down. I would hope that if a company of any sort makes those kind of cuts that they, you know, plan to still be able to upkeep with at the very least the quality. Now the quantity, on the other hand, Viz could definitely, I think, afford to slow down a little bit. I mean, I'm all up for having 30 books a month to go out and buy to the extent that my wallet can afford. But at the same time, I would like to make sure that I still get, you know, series to have an end, even if I have to wait a little longer. And that they still come out, you know, fairly consistent. If it's not every month, I can live with that. But yeah, if they're, you know, getting rid of people, then I definitely think it's time to get rid of a few releases. You know, not stop series, just slow them down a little bit.
Yeah, see, I mean, given that I work in this industry, I know a lot of these people, I would rather they cut books than cut people, especially in this job market. I don't want to see people losing their jobs so they can continue publishing volume 25 of Knights of the Zodiac or whatever.
I totally agree there. It was a shock. I mean, even some of the people I spoke to at Viz, which granted wasn't very many, but still, of those people, all the ones I spoke to, they're gone, and I just couldn't believe how sudden it was, and neither could they, really, so it was a shame all the way around.
I don't know. I mean, I know the fans scream Blue Bloody Murder whenever somebody doesn't finish a book, but when it just gets to a point where it doesn't make any sense to keep publishing, you know, if it costs that much, if they're losing that much money publishing that much stuff. I mean, when I finally looked at, like, here's what Viz's output is, it's like the market clearly cannot handle this. Like, clearly the market is not this big anymore. And, you know, we saw a similar shrinking in the anime market, you know, 4 years ago. And I guess they're sort of following each other because this is, you know, manga had its big bubble in 2005-ish, right? 2004, 2005?
Yeah, I'd say around there, probably up until about 2008, and then the slow decline, I'd say, started.
Right. So it was a bit quicker than anime. Anime took about 6-7 years to really, really start going downhill. So I don't know. I mean, do you think this is the bottom? Do you think there's anybody else is going to go out?
You know, I don't know if I'd say it was the bottom, which isn't to say I want to, you know, think it's going to get worse, but I do think that there are going to be more changes. I'm not going to go on to, you know, what companies I think might, you know, come and go, but I'd say we've already seen all those smaller companies. They are dropping off. They're just not able to keep up. And now you've just got the giants. You've got, you know, Tokyo Pop and Viz still releasing consistently. Yen Press is probably, you know, I guess the manga beacon in the last couple of years, how much they've just expanded and are still getting stronger from the looks of it. And then you have Del Rey, who I guess used to be one of the giants, but they've really tapered off recently as well. So I think it's just a really big shuffle. And who knows how it's going to keep going. But yeah, I definitely think we're going to keep seeing this trend of just a handful of big companies and far less of the smaller ones.
Right. So I wanted to ask you about this because it's obviously a trend in publishing world. How do you feel about moving into the digital sphere? Like if, say, like Yen Press decides to release like an iPad application and charges, you know, $2.99 for a book every month, is that something you would want to move into? I mean, I know you're a big collector, so maybe not. But I mean, how would you feel about something like that? Because it seems like it might be a smart move to me.
Me personally, I would be happy as a clam if books stayed in paper forever. I can't stand reading them on the computer screen. That's just personal preference. Mm-hmm. So for me, the digital move doesn't mean much. On the other hand, that isn't to say I don't think it's a move they have to make. Obviously, manga's greatest competition is, you know, the big scary word, Scanlation's out there, and they are digital. and this is a digital world. This is where their target audience is sitting for hours on end every day, and I think that's where they need to find a way to kind of start monopolizing the content if they want to keep in people's focus, I guess. So though I personally, you know, don't care for it, I do definitely see the merit of it, and I do hope that companies keep getting creative and trying new things to see what works for them.
Right, right, okay. So just to wrap up here, what have you been reading lately that you've liked?
Oh, gee, let me look around here. I probably read about 3-4 books a day, so let's see what's really good. Well, I mean, my girlfriend's a geek, which I just, you know, you mentioned reviewed on ANN. I loved that. I've been waiting for that for a while, and it was a lot of fun. Anyone who is into boys' love will probably get a kick out of it. I also recently read, also from Yen Press, the first 2 volumes of Clamp's new series, Kabato, which I'm always a big Clamp fan, but I didn't go into that expecting much, and it was way, I guess, better than I even expected.
Really? Okay.
And then I guess one last thing. Volume 3 of Butterflies and Flowers from Viz is a good example of them branching out to an audience that they didn't before, because there is so much sexual humor and language that I did not expect coming out of a shoujo beat title. I think people are going to be pretty entertained and surprised, and hopefully 18 plus when they pick it up.
What's that about?
Butterflies and Flowers is about a young woman who used to be from a rich family, and then they lose all their money. Years later, one of her servants comes back because he wants to serve her again, and he's fallen in love with her. And he's creepy and perverse and is obsessed with having sex with her and is also her boss. So it's an interesting comedy shoujo that is aimed at an older audience. It's definitely surprised me on a variety of levels.
Cool. Okay. All right. Well, thanks for your chatting with us. Thanks for your insight. And everyone can see your reviews now on ANN.
All right. No problem. Thanks for having me on.
I really must get some sleep now. Night, night.
All right, that's our show. I want to thank everyone for joining us. As always, don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, and we'll see you next week.